Alex Bird and Geological Time. I'm Julia Scatliff O'Grady. Alex Bird and I met when he was a sophomore in college. He is now an award-winning historian at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Alex's practice, Geological Time, means taking into consideration your entire life, looking for what matters, and forgetting about the rest. He lives in Houston with his wife, Jeanette, who is a public school principal, along with their two children.
What are some things that you feel ill-suited to do? Because as you know, you're a distinguished scholar, and I think another thing you said that you wanted was to die married, and you're doing pretty well on that goal.
I'm definitely dying and still definitely married. So those are good things. Every day more married and more dead. I mean that in the best way. I get up in the morning and I tell myself I'm going to, and this isn't very efficient, tell myself I'm going to work hard until I can't do any more work. And then I'm going to go to sleep and I'm going to get up in the morning and I'll do the same thing again. And the trouble with that in my field, there's a benefit to it, but the trouble with it in my field is that some of the most important work you do as a scholar is a kind of medium term and long term in its construction. And so it takes a certain amount of work every day to get it done, focused work to get it done. And I typically wake up in the morning and behave kind of like FedEx, that whatever's due now, which should have been done last week, I'm going to get it done now. Like, what needs to happen now? So I spend all day doing now stuff, which then makes scholarship, so scholarship suffers. What doesn't suffer, or what suffers less, is I think you end up paying attention to who you have to see that day or what absolutely is due that day. So for me, I probably put too much energy into teaching because most days of the week I have some teaching to do. And so if I have a seminar at 7, I might very inefficiently spend 4 hours on a Wednesday preparing for that seminar. There's no way that it should take that long. It should take about 30 minutes.
But the people in the desks benefit from...
Sometimes. More than half the time they do. But a not insignificant amount of the time, they might not, or they might not have seen a difference between 30 minutes and 4 hours. But that's the habit that I'm in. What I'm wrestling with now, will be the dinosaurs now. I think the great thing about the dinosaurs or what have you is they didn't really know the comet or the asteroid or whatever it was coming, right? They didn't know. The trouble with being human toward the end of the age, right? And that's where we're headed, is I know the asteroid is coming. And so that puts me in a quandary, right? Because the last third of my life, I've been inclined to accept that there's some things that I've tried to change that just haven't changed, or maybe I didn't try hard enough, but you know, there's just some things about me that seem to be constant, and this is one of them. And so back when the asteroid or the comet was a long way away, it was easier to manage this approach to time. But now that I look up and I say, that doesn't look like a star. That's something else headed this way, right?
You mean your own mortality?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then time becomes, like, there are some things I want to do that I thought would be done by now. And so, but they're not. And so some of the things I now have to wrestle with is, what's possible in 15 years? What's possible in 15 years with this pace? And so that's a new question, because I always just assumed if I just, you know, did my thing, things would happen. And some things happen, but some things haven't happened.
Is it possible to say something, or do you not want to say something you thought would be accomplished by now?
The publishing part of my career, I thought would be a little different. I thought that I would have written another book by now, but that hasn't happened. Every day I see the work in front of me that didn't happen yesterday. And 15 years ago, that was one thing. But now it looks like a different thing. I teach African-American history, and people don't typically come to my classes with a whole lot of African-American history. And so some of it's just simple, right? It's just the basic complexity of Black life and the notion that, I don't mean this as a harsh critique, but racialization and racism is so powerful in America that it occludes really smart, really giving, really wonderful people from sometimes seeing that Black folks now and Black folks in time have in their circumstances the same types of human responses that exist through time for all kinds of humans, right? That sounds terrible, but it's an actual thing. If you grow up in America, it's not uncommon to struggle with the humanity of Black folks. And that sounds, I'm not talking about Trump level stuff, right? I'm talking about just not, sometimes it's not seeing everything in epic proportions. So the civil, or just a kind of American idea of the civil rights movement, sometimes it moves people towards seeing Black folks as kind of heroic in ways. And a lot of folks in the civil rights movement were heroic, right? But then what it does is some folks weren't, right? And so you've got to deal with that. And so I had a conversation this morning with a student and who's got an interesting project and had just finished reading about Kenneth and Mamie Clark's doll tests, which were related to Brown v. Board, the desegregation case, and was trying to relate that to, or wanted to, because some scholars had also related it to instances of academic underperformance and anxiety in Black, low-income, middle-grade students, right? And so one of the things this student was interested in exploring is the ways in which some of the anxieties that appear to be present in the doll tests manifest themselves among 13 and 14 and 15-year-old kids right now in middle school. Now, here's the problem with that, right? And if you read about 15-year-old Black kids in New Orleans, which this student had a couple of weeks ago, you can find what looks like a lot of those anxieties, right? And so the idea is then I can connect this to Brown in this large, epic kind of scope. But here's the problem. 13-year-old kids, no matter where they are, right, are sometimes full of angst and anxiety and don't think much of their abilities. But what happens in America, right, and if you're not helped, is you can see 13-year-olds acting like 13-year-olds and connect that to a kind of anti-intellectualism, a Black anti-intellectualism, or some type of Black psychological issue that needs to be addressed. Well, maybe it is, but also maybe this person's just 13 in New Orleans, right? And it's not related to something. It's actually related to something larger in the sweep of history, which is adolescence, as opposed to something smaller in the sweep of history.
Alex Alex and Jeanette were married on a friend's farm by a pond near Berea College in Kentucky. They wrote their own vows, ones they continue to live by to this day. Geological time is a practice of perspective, like writing and living by your vows. It is taking a bird's eye view as you travel through your days.
It makes marriage wonderful because if you are committed to someone to the end of the age, that makes any one thing relatively unimportant or easily managed. So if I'm mad, right, what passes for mad for me, Jeanette, about something, really, how much use is it? Really, how long am I going to stew over that madness when we're going to be together until we die, right? If the commitment is the most important thing, then almost everything else has to fade away. Jen and I don't see each other as much as we used to, right? Like for married people, we don't see each other a whole lot. So I see her more in the summer. My wife is a school principal, and her day is organized quite differently from mine. She gets up about 4:18, 4:15, so not unlike you. Gets up really early, wakes me up just a little. I get upset about that. I go back to sleep. I don't get up and make her breakfast, which makes me a terrible husband. I just go back to sleep. And then she works. She goes exercise at 5 a.m., and then she's at work by 7. She goes to the Y, where she leads an exercise program 3 days a week, and other 2 days she exercises on her own. Then she goes to school, where she's a school principal, and so she has to be very conventionally organized and efficient, and she is. She's a list maker. She gets things done, which you have to do if you're a school principal. You can't let things slip. And then she comes home and she's in bed relatively early. And sometimes I teach at night. So I see her during the school year. I think we may see each other a little bit more sleep, like each other being sleep than each other being awake. And that's been the case for like years. Right? That's been the case for many years, and just made worse, but I don't mean worse in a bad way, by having had two teenage children at home at a time, because then you're running around with them. I think my approach to dadhood was more conventionally aligned. Like I thought that you show kids stuff, you did stuff with kids, and that's how. And then they would do those things. that's not true, right? None of that's true. And as they get older, I'm seeing that. And so trying to make my approach with them more like my approach with Jeanette. People who talk about how to have a good marriage say things like, you know, you got to have time. You got to make time for each other. You got to go out on dates. I'm like, what? Right? How do you? Who are these people who have time to make for each other? And so one of our approaches, I think, is to not worry about some of that stuff and to know that we're probably going to make a whole lot of time for each other in a couple years, right? But it's only been like 20 years that we've been waiting to have. We had a lot of years where we had 10 years, we had a lot of time with each other. And now we've had maybe almost 20 years where not as much time with each other, but working together really hard. I think that's the difference between my approach to time. Like the people say, you got to go out every week. I'm like, I don't have time to go out with my wife every week. I don't even know that she wants to go out with me every week. But I do look forward to getting to know her again in the ways that we knew each other for the first 10 years of our marriage. And I think that's coming, and I'm not anxious about the state our union is in now, because it's kind of, it's a finite amount of time. I just think I know what I would like to have at the end.
What's that?
I'd like to have a couple more books done. The two books I'm working on now, I wish they would be done, and they'll probably be done. But those aren't the two books that I imagined that I would have done before I kick off, right? And so that's...
You're not kicking off in 15 years, though.
See, but now here we go.
Okay, tell me.
Well, so I think I'm at the age where my dad died, and I'm past the age where my sister died. And so, but that does, so who knows, right? My mom and I are the folks left from our family, but because my sister was gone, I guess she's in her 30s or 40s when she left. My dad was in his 50s when he left. I don't take for granted, like, this is a long life. Like, I'm 51. In my family, that's kind of a, like, for half of the people in my family, that's the longest, that's a long life. So I hope I'll get to 75 and get to retire. But also know I got on a plane and one day and took my wife and my kid from Texas to New Jersey a couple weeks after having seen my dad. And I landed in New Jersey and the next day he was dead, right? So
do you think that this, the drumbeat of mortality is felt more now than when we first talked about the
subject?
Oh,
way more. Yeah, way more.
Is that a good thing, maybe? Or do you think we should just stop thinking about it?
I think I got to reframe it somehow.
Well, you're a historian. How might you reframe it?
I got two things I can do. The first one isn't reframing. The second one, the first one is do the thing that I've never been able to do, and that's get a little better at these things that result in getting things done. The second thing is to pay more attention to the parts of my life and career that have more benefited from this approach. So taking a long-term approach to my personal life, to my children, to my relationships has mostly worked. And having this approach has not affected negatively my teaching, my work with students, but it has negatively affected scholarly productivity and anything that requires, you know, hard deadlines.
Hi, it's Julia. I'm back in the studio to do a debrief with our podcast producer, Jim Haverkamp.
We're recording this in June of 2020, so we're in the pandemic era. And I feel like we've all had a couple of months now to look at our lives in this geologic scale where we've been kind of forced to slow down and think about things and think about the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that it just keeps going. And more cases are resulting. And I think when I try to bring this time into the light a little bit and to think about it in connection with geological time, you know, the practice is really meant for you to step back from your life some and to realize that over the span of my lifetime, this era will seem quite small. So that when things begin to envelop my emotions, my thoughts, that they can just as easily be put into greater perspective if I let that happen. And so with geological time, I think the most important thing about this practice is to actually have that word in your head, to say geological time to yourself when you're frustrated, when you're in a whole slew of cars trying to get home, when you're wondering, when will this pandemic be over, to stop asking that question.
this is maybe not entirely germane, but I know Alex talked about the different phases of his life with his partner and how they sort of had 10 years together and then had kids. And but what you just described in terms of dealing with the pandemic makes me think of what it was like to have an infant. There are certain times, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning as I'm rocking this baby who will not stop crying, and this is the 10th night in a row that I think I inadvertently discovered that practice of thinking, like, it won't always be like this.
I don't think you necessarily have to be a Pollyanna or to think optimistically about everything, but I do think it's important to realize that, yes, things go away. Things pass. This too shall pass. Alex talks about how when he gets mad at Jeanette, who I love both dearly, when he gets mad, he realizes it doesn't matter. We're going to be married. We're going to be married until one of us dies. And so to just kind of try to let things go and to live in this space of geological time. He talked about the comet and the dinosaurs and how, you know, they didn't know it was coming, you know. So we try so hard to control things that are beyond our control. And so this is a practice of spaciousness and patience and to stop asking when. It's not, however, you know, in the face of injustice, I don't think geological time is such a great practice. I think there are times where you have to be urgent and push for things. But that's not what this practice is. This is just helping you to be patient when you need to stay in the game. Thanks to Alex Bird for appearing in this episode. You can learn more about his work at the Rice University Department of History website. You can find his award-winning book, Captives and Voyagers, Black Migrants Across the 18th Century British Atlantic World, at Amazon.com. This concludes the Good Busy podcast for this season.
To leave a comment about the Good Busy podcast and read more about me, Julia Scatliff O'Grady, go to jsogrady.com.
The Good Busy podcast is written and directed by me, Julia Scatliff O'Grady, produced and edited by Jim Haverkamp, and recorded at Shadowbox Studio in Durham, North Carolina. Our theme music is by Joyce Fentimiglia. If you like what you hear, you can order a copy of Good Busy, Productivity, Procrastination, and the Endless Pursuit of Balance at Amazon.com or rcwms.org. Thanks for listening.